Good evening, everybody. I'm Blair Garrett. I'm an alcoholic.
Blair.
I want to let you know it's a pleasure and honor to be here tonight. I'm real grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll do anything that's asked of me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And speaking is not one of my favorites, but, Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life, and I'd do anything to give it back to another alcoholic. And Mark, thank you for asking me. I'm the secretary and the speaker getter of a meeting up in Tehachapi on Saturday night. And by doing that, I'm fair game for other speakers that come up. They want me to come down somewhere else. So thank you for your 10 minutes. That was great. And welcome the newcomers. I'm glad you guys are here. And welcome home. And do yourself a favor and stay, please. I'm sober today due to the grace of a very loving God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, God got me to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, but this program, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, has given me that God in my life today. And for that, I'm forever in debt. There's three things we need in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got those things. One is a sobriety date, and that's March 14th, 1982. I have a sponsor. His name's Bob Tutel. He's been with me for about 4 years, and previous to that, I had a sponsor for like 39 years before he passed away. And that gentleman saved my life. I also have a home group. That's that Saturday night speaker meeting up in Tehachapi. And another thing, I forgot. Huh? Oh, okay. Thank you. You guys saw the quote. I'm getting rid of it. Okay. It seems today like most of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous came from that dysfunctional family. You know, the parents were drinking or using or whatever, and there was chaos at the home, and free booze and everything else. That wasn't my story. I came from a very loving family. I was born and raised in Long Beach, and my parents were Mormons, of all things. And Mormons don't drink or smoke or any of that, cuss or anything like that. So I came from a great family. There was none of that abuse or anything like that. I had two brothers. I had a sister. And, everything was actually pretty good. We weren't rich. We weren't poor. We got everything we needed and a lot of the stuff we wanted. And so, nothing was wrong with my life. But, I can relate to what you're going on. You don't feel part of not good enough. Well, my problem was, when I got old enough to figure out what mom and dad did to have kids, it's like, uh-oh, because I was born a twin, and I was born the youngest twin. So my great mind here, my great perception, comes to this great conclusion that, when mom and dad, I didn't know the process at that time, what went on, but I thought, okay, mom says, hey, pa, we want a baby, okay, and they did this ordeal, the one-time shot, and 9 months later a kid came out. I didn't know you guys got to have fun, or we got to have fun and practice and party, through the rest of the time. That was my thought. Okay, they wanted a kid. 9 months later, what the hell happens? They get two. I'm the youngest. And so my mind goes to, I'm not wanted. I'm not part of. I'm an oops. And, I started off with that poem I got early on, and it's like, okay, what can I do? What can I do to fill this? I need you to like me. I need you to like me. I need toys. I need your approval. I need this, And I was always out there searching for special attention just to feel normal. And it never happened, until I found this thing called, alcohol. Okay. I started pretty young. I found, alcohol in trash cans and alleys on my way to school and in elementary school. I remember one day sitting in class in elementary school, they had those old wooden desks with the lift up. and I was sitting there and I got real embarrassed. My teacher's looking at me and she's going, Blair, what's wrong? I says, I spilled whiskey on my desk. I'm in third grade. And I was thinking, you know, I was searching that sense of ease and comfort that comes at, you know, that first drink in third grade. Luckily, I didn't get in trouble, you know, and I did, of course, I didn't drink all the time. Couldn't have it, you know, whenever I found it, it's like, you know, that stuff works. I'm going to use it when I found it. And, you know, so it was very rare, but I knew there was something there, and I liked it. When I got older, you know, I was still searching for that alcohol, so it became more and more prevalent. And, you know, I always felt, you know, uncomfortable in my own skin until I had that alcohol. And, you know, it was weird because I was really a popular guy. I had a bunch of friends, but I'd be hanging out with you, then I'd want to be with Mark, and I'd want to be with Mark, and, you know, I'd hang out with Mark, and I think that's cool, then I'd want to be somewhere else. I remember in high school, you know, I had a girlfriend, I would date with her, take her out on dates, and, you know, I was happy with her for maybe 2 hours, then I wanted to go hang out with the boys and drink. I started hanging out with the boys and drinking, and I wanted to be somewhere else. I was never comfortable, you know, but that alcohol helped the situation. So I'm no dummy. That's going to help us keep drinking. Some things happened in high school, or after high school, actually. That girlfriend, we were engaged in our senior year of high school. Right after high school, she found drugs, and she found alcohol, and she dumped me. You know, and so what do you do? What do I do? You know, that drinking hits a little bit more. A year later, my mother passed away. And, you know, what do you do about that? That pain and suffering. You take a drink. That relieves it. I can remember my mom got in a car accident. And I remember the day in the hospital. I was out running errands for her, and I went back to the hospital. And she was doing pretty good. And so me and my brother, my two brothers, went home. And we stopped at the market across the street. And we got some alcohol. An old cardboard box. We had 2 6-packs, a gallon of wine, and some whiskey. And we're going to celebrate. My mom's feeling good. I get this call. I answer the phone. It's my sister. My mother had passed away. And I remember looking at that alcohol. We were going to use it to celebrate. Shouldn't be worth anything. Now there's nothing to celebrate. But my mind goes somewhere else. I need that alcohol now because of that pain. You know, I was always able to justify that drink no matter what. But after her death, I went off, you know, we're off and running again. So that went on and on and on. And it worked. You know, it really did work. It made me feel okay. It saved my life, actually. But it got worse and worse, you know, and it got to the point where I crossed that line, which it talks about in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcohol was no longer a luxury, it was a necessity. I needed that drink. I needed that drink to survive. I needed it. And I didn't want it. You know, I wanted to quit. I didn't want to be controlled by alcohol, but alcohol was controlling me. And I can remember, you know, saying almost every day, well, today I'll drink. I got started, you know, tomorrow I'll stop. Tomorrow would come. I'd wake up. I'm shaky. I'm nervous. And I'm scared. And I'm uncomfortable in my skin. You know, and I'm thinking, again, one more time, one or two drinks will calm those nerves. One or two drinks will make me okay. But, you know, once I take that drink, I'm off and running. And I don't know why. I didn't know why until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and read that doctor's opinion. And the doctor's opinion explained to me, you know, you suffer from a twofold disease, a mental obsession and an allergy to alcohol. Once we take that drink, my body craves more, you know. And once I got here, I read that. It's like, well, now that makes sense. That's completely, you know. But, you know, that was my life. I actually could not do anything. It was so sad and so sick that I couldn't go to the liquor store to buy more liquor. I needed a drink. I couldn't go to the local bar to drink. Before I hadn't had some drinks before that. I remember getting up in the morning, having to go to work when I could. You know, get my eye chest out, fill it up with beer, because I always had to have that beer just in case, or that alcohol, whatever it was, just in case. And that went on and on and on. And I desperately wanted to quit, but I couldn't. It was the same story over and over. Each morning I would do that. And at the end of my drinking, things were getting a little worse. You know, my family wasn't real happy with me. My business was going down the tubes. You know, I was getting some physical problems at the end of this drinking career. It was a pain in my side, but I always said it was in my back. In the last year and a half or so of my drinking, I was urinating blood, urinating, crapping, and throwing up blood. And I kept blaming it on stupid excuses. Oh, I'm brushing my teeth too hard, or I got hemorrhoids or something like that. But, it's that pain just kept getting worse and worse. And at the end of it, I'm in that, God, that awful piece of shit. I just hate myself. I'm going down and down. And my feelings for myself are getting worse. And, of course, every time my feelings get worse, I need another drink to solve that problem. And that loneliness and despair that comes with that. I remember having a New Year's party at my house. It was in Lakewood, California. There was probably 50 family and friends there at this house, and we were having a good time New Year's Eve, my wife and my kid and friends and stuff. And I was in the back bedroom by myself, hating myself. I couldn't stand it. My brother walked in. He goes, Blair, this party is great. What's going on? This is fun. And I'm just going, I want to kill myself. I wasn't enjoying life at all. And it kept getting worse. And it got to the point where, it talks about in the big book, I can't live with alcohol or I can't live without it. And suicide was an option, but, I'm too scared to do that. I can't pull that trigger. I can't do that other stuff, whatever it takes. And I heard on the TV, there was an advertisement for Memorial Hospital in Long Beach. It was an alcohol recovery place and a detox. And I'm thinking, well, maybe I should call. And I picked up that 1,000-pound telephone and I called this place. And I explained to a doctor, and I explained to this doctor what was going on. And he says, well, usually, we have you come in, we do a physical, and we check you out, and we do a bunch of questions, and then we, see if you needed to be admitted or something else. He goes, I think you ought to come in right now. And I'm going, but, I'm busy. I got my own business. I got to do this, and I got to do that. I can't come in, And I says, how about if I come in Friday after work? I'll come in Friday after work. You guys fix me. I'll be out on Monday. And so he agreed that. And so I told my wife, and I guess she didn't believe me, because when it came to Friday night, she had plans, and she said I was staying home to babysit. And so one more time, I get another resentment, and I'm off and running. And I remember coming to on Monday morning. My wife had already gotten up. She'd gotten the baby to the babysitter, the son to school. And I crawled out of that bed and went into the kitchen, and I fell down on the floor, and I curled up like a little baby in so much pain. I'm lying there saying to myself, God, what have I done to myself? What have I done? I'm looking around this kitchen, and I built those cabinets in that kitchen. I handmade those myself and hung them. That countertop I put in, I said, God, see, I was worth something. But I'm no good drunk now. Now I'm lying there, and I'm thinking around the corner from that kitchen, there's a den that I put on. I kept thinking, see, I used to be able to do something, but I'm worthless. God, what can I do? And, God suggested I call that hospital again, which I did, and I got a ride to that hospital. And I remember walking up the steps, entering that hospital, thinking one more time, just me against the world. One more time, nobody cares. One more time, poor pitiful Blair, right? Not knowing that once I walked out the other side of that hospital, that I never had to be lonely again, because they introduced me to a program called Alcoholics Anonymous in there. So I went in, this doctor ran some tests on me. He says, the results will be in tomorrow. He says, you're physically, you're mentally, and you're spiritually bankrupt. He says, I'm going to give you a couple of shots. I'll put you out for, you know, 24 hours, and we'll come back in and we'll check you up. And he did. It was almost 24 hours to a minute. He came back in, and it's like 2 o'clock the next day or something, with the results of the test. And he told me, my liver was swollen up 3 times the size. He says, you've been infected, and you've been infected for a long time. And he says, if you continue to drink, you'll be dead in 2 weeks. And at that moment, I felt God was doing something for me that I couldn't do for myself. Because at that moment, that mental obsession I had been carrying around for years was relieved from me. Okay? That mental obsession. And I was like, God, this is great. But, you know, the physical part I could live with. If I died, that might have been good news, actually. But what the hell was going on was up in my mind, and that living hell in my mind, and I just couldn't live with that. So, you know, I'm asking the doctor, and he says, well, you know, what's my liver count? And he says, well, it doesn't matter, because everybody's tolerance is different. And I says, well, no, I want to know, because I have a friend that, you know, had the same problem. He stopped drinking for 9 months, and, you know, the doctor said after that he could start drinking again. So I'm thinking, well, maybe I can do the same thing, and I want to compare my count to his. At least mine should be better than his, or whatever, you know. And I kept prodding him. I kept asking him, you know, what is it? He says, well, after a couple of minutes, he goes, well, let me put it this way. According to any doctor, any medical books, he goes, you're dead. You're clinically and legally dead to all the tests I ran. He goes, I can take you down to the morgue right now. We could bury you tomorrow. You're not here. That's where alcohol took me. And I didn't know what to do. You know, what do you do? And this kind doctor suggested I go to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Come on. You know, I'm dying of alcoholism. Anything go to Alcoholics Anonymous? It's like, uh-uh. And, you know, that river called denial. But I took a suggestion. I went to my first meeting. That was probably Wednesday night. And I walked into this meeting. It was a men's stag meeting, which I thought was unfair. You know, should have been at least some pretty girls to look at or something in there. But and I walked into this meeting and sat down, and they started the meeting, and they went around in the room and they introduced themselves. And the first guy says, hi, I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic. And it's like, what? What's this guy doing? And the next guy said, hi, I'm John, I'm an alcoholic. And then it was Dawn, I'm an alcoholic. And he goes, you guys are crazy, what are you doing? And it got to me and I couldn't spit out those words. I said, hi, I'm blah, 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 blah. But I kept going to those meetings because my life is over, you know. What else am I going to do? You know, I can't go out and function. I can't go to parties. You know, I can barely make it to work without shaking and stuff. So I started going to those meetings, and I was going to 5 or 6 meetings a week, and all I could do was go to those meetings. And I'd walk in, and I would hide from the secretary so they wouldn't call on me to lead the meeting. I'd hide from the leader so they wouldn't call on me to share, but I kept going. You know, after a while, something started happening. I started feeling every time I went into those rooms, I felt a little love. And I saw hope. And I saw something in the eyes of these guys that were before me, that they were okay with themselves. And they didn't have to drink alcohol to do this. And my life was over, so I just kept going to those meetings. And each meeting, I started getting a little bit more hope. But I couldn't go to your stupid potlucks. You know, I couldn't go to your bowling. I couldn't go to Denny's afterwards, you know, or your conventions or your conferences. I showed up at the meeting, said, hi, how are you, and left. But I would feel better after every meeting. Remember leaving one meeting, I was in my truck, and I'm driving down the road, and I'm singing and dancing. It's like, oh, shit, nobody's watching. You know, but it made me feel good. But I kept doing this for about 9 months. And, you know, I'm still suffering from untreated alcoholism because I'm not drinking to make me feel good, but I'm not doing anything in the Alcoholics Anonymous to make me feel good. I'm not doing the steps. I'm not being a service. I'm not doing anything. And that pain was there. And I did something that was real hard for me, and that was to put out my hand and ask this guy if he would sponsor me. And he said yes. And that scared me because I knew he was going to take me through the books of Alcoholics Anonymous. But there was a couple other things that that gentleman did for me because he knew my situation. This guy was a miracle. He had all the right answers for me. He said, yesterday I go to this meeting called Bellflower Big Book Group. You know, every place I was going, there was a bunch of old farts. You know, sat around and did nothing and smoked, you know, wouldn't have coffee. And it's like, you guys aren't any fun, and now look at me, huh? So I went to this meeting called the Bellflower Big Book Group. These guys are alive. These guys are having fun. They're stomping their feet, and they're doing this and doing that. And it's like, wow, there is life after all, you know, after drinking. And then he said, yesterday, get some commitments. He put me as a greeter. Mr. Shy Blair can't talk to you guys. He puts me at the front door to greet you guys. And that helped. It got me over that stage. But there was another meeting I went to. It was a Los Alamitos meeting, Tuesday night, 8 p.m. speaker meeting. And this one night, there was a speaker there, and she shared my story. She shared that she was born a twin, and she was the youngest one. And that made me feel at home. Okay, I'm in the right spot. So I hung out with a sponsor. We went through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We went through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, page by page, sentence by sentence, word by word. And for that, I'm truly grateful to this gentleman. We started on the steps, and you know, the first step, I'm powerless over alcohol. Well, shit, I'm powerless over everything, you know. If I'm powerless over alcohol, what do I need to do is find a power greater than ourselves. And we come to the second step, you know, and the second part of the second step is implying something, you know. It's talking about maybe I'm insane. No, you know, and truly I am insane because I did some stupid stuff. But he explained the insanity that they were referring to was doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Okay, I can handle that part. And we get to the third step. It's like, okay, you know, I was born and raised Mormon. I can turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That was easy. You know, things started getting better. But when things started getting better, I'm starting to pat myself on the back. And I'm starting to take it back, and my mind's going again. You know, and things start getting crappy again. You know, so I'm playing that third step shuffle back and forth, back and forth. You know, when things get bad, okay, God, you got it. When things get good, I've got it. You know, I can handle that. And it's like, I kept doing that. And I went back to my sponsor again. I have the answers all the time. I says, you know, what's going on? And he took out the big book and read me a portion in there and saying, you know, this step, although it's a crucial and vital step, it has little permanent effect unless immediately followed by a strenuous effort to face the things that are blocking you from the sunlight of the Spirit. Oh my God, you guys are talking four step. No, I'm not doing it. Why should I do that four step? I've been hiding all this stuff. I've been burying this stuff in my gut. You know, all that anger, fear, resentments, it's been down there. I don't share it with anybody, but he's telling me to do this four step. It's like, no. And it took a while. It took a while till that pain was hurting again. You know, that pain is a great motivator. And I finally got pen and paper, and I took the pen and paper. I started doing that four step, and oh my God, I couldn't wait to get it done. And I get this four step done, I call Don, my sponsor. I got it done. Let's get together. I want to do this fifth step because I knew there was a solution. I knew if I gave it to him, I wouldn't have to carry it anymore. And so, you know, hey Don, let's get this done. I'll be over tonight. Oh, I'm busy tonight. Tomorrow night? Oh. Let me check my calendar. He was busy for 2 weeks. Another resentment. I had to add to that list. But anyway, we got to the fifth step. And those promises and those things in Alcoholics Anonymous you guys were telling me about started happening. I did that fifth step, and the book tells you to go home and take the book down off the shelf and review if you've done everything right. I went down to Mbosa Chica, Lifeguard Station 16, because that's where I felt close to God. And I did that 6 and 7 step down there on the beach. And I'll tell you, I have never felt so good in my life after doing that 7 step. All that stuff I've been carrying around for years and years and years was released, and I'm free. I felt a freedom that I had never felt before. And God, what was it? You know, what an amazing feeling that was. And we got into the 7th and 8th step. I remember doing some of the men's, and one of the men's was my son. When I was drinking, my son and I didn't have the greatest relationship in the world. I remember one time he said some stuff to his mother that he shouldn't have said, and I grabbed him by his shirt and I put him up on the wall and I told him not to ever talk to her like that again. And he's hanging up there on the wall looking at me eye to eye, and he says, "I hate your guts." And I was ready to punch this kid out. And it dawned on me, is how in the hell can I expect this kid to like me when I do not like myself? And I remember just setting him down easy and walking away. And I made amends to that son of mine. We became closer and closer. I remember he met a girl and he got engaged and he was getting married. He invited me to his wedding. Miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not only did he invite me to the wedding, I was his best man. You know, how could things get better than that? I was making amends to my sister, my older sister, about what was going on. And, well, she was asking, you know, why did you drink? What was going on? And I told her the story about, you know, not fitting in, not being loved. I was an unwanted child. She gave me those puppy eye look, and she grabbed me and she hugged me. And she goes, "Blair, you were the answer to their prayers. They were praying for twins. They wanted twins." And I'm going, geez, you know, I've been thinking all this all my life, that I'm an unwanted child. Now all of a sudden they want, you know, I'm a wanted child. Wow, isn't that cool? And it took me maybe 45 seconds, 30 seconds or whatever. And it's like, aren't they lucky they got me? But by doing those amends and not just, you know, saying I'm sorry, you go in there and say, this is what I did. This is what I did. You know, how can I repair this? And is there anything I left off? Can you tell me something else? Let me know. You know, it's not about me. It's what I can do for you to make those things straight. And the Miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we got to the 12th step, and the sponsor said, okay, you know, after a spiritual awakening, you need to carry this to other alcoholics. You need to give this thing a way to keep it. And it's like, you know, I'm still fuzzy, you know. I'm still having some of the after effect of alcohol. And it's like, this doesn't make a bit of sense. How do you give it away to keep it? And that doesn't make a bit of sense. He goes, no, you have to do this. You'll understand later. So he said, just as I do, get in this thing called H&I, Hospitals and Institution. Now, I'm still not comfortable speaking and sharing at meetings or anything else, but I take a suggestion because, you know, he's done everything right for me so far. So I go and get involved in this thing called H&I. I remember you had to go, it was in Long Beach area, it was Harbor area H&I, and you had to go to 3 business meetings to get a panel, and I did my 3 business meetings, monthly business meetings, and it was time to get a panel. Now God's got a humor. So the meeting's going, and I'm looking forward to getting my panel, and the meeting's boring. I'm not sure what's going on in the meeting. They have a list of all the institutions and hospitals and stuff they go into. So I'm looking at that list, and I'm marking down the top panel I want, right? Number 1, that's not open. Here's number 2. That isn't open. I'll take number 3. And the meeting's still dragging on, so I turn that sheet over, and I write down the 3 meetings I will not take no matter what. Number 1, number 2, and number 3. And like I said, God's got a sense of humor. I walked out of that room that night with the number 1 panel I would not take. Metropolitan Hospital, the lockup ward, mental institution. These guys are crazy in there. And they want me to go in there, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I might just be a little bit, I have a little bit more on ball than these guys. But I did that, and I started this thing called H&I, and they talk about the high of H&I. And I went to that meeting, and I understood that high. And I understood what he was talking about giving it away to keep it. You know, because I walked out of there feeling 10 times better than I walked in there. And that's the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous, to give it away. Give it away and keep it. And I've been involved in H&I for almost 40 years now, so it's a miracle. I've been involved in every part of H&I. Last year we actually did, for the first time in over 40 years, we had a joint conference of Southern California and Northern California. I was part of that. Well, there were about three of us. We've been trying to do this for 12 years, and we put it together last year, and it really worked out. It was fantastic. And my experiences in H&I are just unbelievable. And my life today, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, is unbelievable. I have the best life in the world. And today, you know, I don't wake up. I'm sorry. Today I wake up. I used to come to. And I come to with the shakes and the fears. And, you know, it's like, oh, God, I have to face that world today. Today what I do is I wake up, and I've got three dogs, and they're licking my face, so they get me up, and then once I get them away, I do my exercises, and then I do my morning prayers and my morning meditation. And I ask God to get out of myself, relieve me of myself, and let me do what you need. Show me how to help another alcoholic. And by getting out of myself, you know, I don't have to worry about stuff to me. I trust in God. I let Him do that. I say those morning prayers, God, you got me. Show me what to do. I am powerless. I came in here powerless. I'm still powerless. And this program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a God in my life today. And so I give it to Him. And by doing that, you know, my life is okay. I have acceptance today. You know, I used to think, you know, I've had my projections out there. I was always thinking you should do this, do that. All those projections are just a premeditated resentment, and I understand that today. So I let Him have it. And you know, I've been through some hard stuff. Life isn't always easy. There's stuff that goes down after you get sober. About 10 years ago, I'll tell you this story. 10 years ago, we were coming, I haul horses, transport horses for a living, and we were in Nebraska dropping off our last horse, and it was in a snowstorm. And somehow my phone dropped, and I ran it over. So I picked up the phone, the screen's cracked, the phone's not working, but I got, was hooked up to the truck, right? So I can answer callers and everything on the truck, and so it's okay. You know, we're driving home. It happened to be Christmas Eve when we got home. I couldn't get the phone fixed because it was Christmas Eve, and the next day was Christmas, so if I had to make a phone call, I'd go out to the truck and let it, you know, hook up, and I'd make the phone calls. After Christmas, the next day, I go to AT&T store to get a new phone or see if they would fix this one, and they told me, well, go ahead to the Apple store and they'll fix it for you. So I'm walking out of this AT&T store with my phone, cracked phone. This phone hasn't worked for 3 days. The phone rings. I push a button. I pushed the screen just for chicks. There was a voice in the other room. It's like, this phone's working. It was my ex-wife. She's calling me to tell me our baby's in the hospital, and it's serious. My phone hasn't worked. No. Somebody's behind this. Something's behind this all. So I get the message, she lives in Las Vegas, and I said, I'll be right there. My daughter had been in the hospital, she had surgery. What happened, she got a bad infection, she had coronary arrest. It lasted so long that she had severe brain damage that wasn't repairable. So I go there and I spend that time, 2 weeks with my daughter in the hospital. And I was able to walk through that with the help of a higher power that I have today. And the help of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I called my sponsor who had lost his son. So he had been through that before. I called another gentleman, Mo. He had lost a daughter, and he helped me through it. And I had all your guys' support, and I had the support from my higher power. And I was able to make that through that. That's the worst thing any parent can go through, is to lose a child. And I was, you know, acceptance, but that doesn't mean there wasn't any pain or sorrow or hurt. But I was able to accept it. She was going to a better place. The funeral we held for her was in Las Vegas. I had friends from Alcoholics Anonymous flying in from L.A. You know, there was more friends from Alcoholics Anonymous that was at that funeral than my own family. And that's the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a beautiful wife today. I got married probably about 14 years ago. I hate to admit it, but I probably 12-stepped her. Our 13th stepped her, I'm sorry. Our 13th stepped her. She was only 11 months sober. And I've been staying back from this lady for a while. But there was a rodeo down in Bakersfield, you know. And I couldn't talk to the people in the rodeo to postpone that for another month. And so, you know, I asked her if she'd go to the rodeo with me. And she said, yeah. And actually, you know, according to, I don't know if you remember Shalaby. Yeah, it's not a 13th step anymore, it's a tradition. So. And I took her to that rodeo 2 years later. On that same date, we got married, and we have a lovely life today. We live up in Tatchby, we have 6 acres, and, you know, 3 horses, 3 dogs, 3 cats, and just a wonderful life. And it's all due to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe in the circle and the triangle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love doing every part of it. I love the bottom part, the recovery. You know, first of all, we got to be okay with ourselves. Then we can get into unity, you know. And now I can go to the roundups, and I can go to the conferences and coffee with you guys afterwards. Then the service. The service is one of the most important parts of this program to me, is giving it away to keep it, what my sponsor taught me years ago. And I keep doing this. You know, I've been doing H&I for 39, 40 years, and I love it. And some of the stories I could tell you about that are amazing, you know. Walking a guy out of prison that's been in there for 30-some-odd years and taking him out, who is a pop killer. You know, I have to take him to the police station and watch this man turn his life around, you know. The gifts. And in closing, I want to thank the people that walked here before me. I want to thank the old-timers that were here, that carried that message, that stood up for the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, so was there for me. But I wasn't welcoming the newcomers, because if it's not for the newcomers, we can't give it away. If we can't give it away, we can't keep it. So welcome, and do yourself a favor and stay here. And I think I will close with that, and thank you guys for listening.